This podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of the PBSC Queen's Law Student Volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Pro Bono Radio at Queen's Law. We're your hosts, Andrew, Emily, and Rebecca. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is part two as we explore why are American courts becoming politicized? What's the problem and is it a problem that can happen in Canada as well? We're excited to have Adam Goldenberg with us today. Adam graduated from Yale Law and is currently an associate in McCarthy Petro's litigation group and has been counsel on all levels of court in Ontario and in 16 appeals to the Supreme Court of Canada. I feel like actually one of my professors has assigned a Supreme Court hearing for us to watch with you in it. Adam worked as speechwriter to Michael Ignatieff while he served as leader of the official opposition and as acting director of communications and a senior advisor to the Minister for the Ontario Ministry of Research, Innovation, and Science. Adam later clerked for Justice James McPherson, Janet Simmons,
and for Eleanor Cronk on the Ontario Court of Appeals,
and for Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin on the Supreme Court of Canada. He's written for Maclean's, appeared on the CBC. Adam has unique insight into that intersection between the judiciary and politics, and we're very lucky to have him with us here today. So thank you for joining us. Yeah, of course. Thank you for joining us for part two of the discussion. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. So before we begin, we'd like to provide a quick overview for how federal judges are appointed in this country and provide some background. If you'd like a deeper dive, we have a more extensive discussion in our last episode. Firstly, what do we mean by politicization of the courts? It can mean a bunch of different things, but for the purposes of this podcast, we mean the systematic effort to appoint partisan judges through almost any means necessary, who are expected to rule through an ideological lens rather than fidelity to precedent, the law, the rule of law, and the Constitution. Unlike the United States, where federal judges, including Supreme Court judges, are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, in Canada we have nomination boards filled with qualified independent judges, experienced lawyers, and ranking members of the legal community, creating and curating lists of people they believe should be judges and submitting that information to the Minister of Justice. Since 1988, candidates have been able to apply for consideration as well. This process has changed over the years, though, especially for nominations to the Supreme Court. In 2016, a new process was put in place by the new Trudeau government where qualified lawyers and persons holding judicial office across Canada who wish to be considered for a vacancy could apply to the Independent Advisory Board for Supreme Court of Canada judicial appointments to the Office of the Commissioner for Federal Judicial Affairs. Boy, that is a mouthful. After the Prime Minister makes a choice, the Minister of Justice and the Chairperson of the Advisory Board appear before the House of Commons Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights to explain how the chosen nominee meets the statutory requirements and the criteria. So far, three of the justices have been nominated on this process: Malcolm Rowe, Sheila Martin, and Nicholas Cassaray. It is important to keep in mind that none of these processes are formal. According to the Constitution, there is no formal role for the provinces or the House of Commons in this nomination or appointment process. And throughout Canadian history, the courts have been popular places for governments to exercise political patronage. Even under the new process, it's still only a recommendation to the Prime Minister. So this leads to our first question for Adam. In many ways, our way of appointing Supreme Court justices and judges as a whole is significantly less democratic and accountable than the American system. It's far easier to appoint partisan, unqualified judges. So why haven't our leaders done so? Prime Minister Harper appointed 8 judges, but would still have the court regularly strike down his legislation. He lost on assisted dying, prostitution, mandatory minimums for gun violence, Senate reform, just to name a few. Take it away, Adam.
Thanks, Andrew. I think I might push back at your statement that our process is less democratic. I think we have to think about what we mean by democratic, which is a loaded term. There's no question that in the United States, the judicial appointments process is more transparent in the sense that there is a formal, constitutionally required role for the Senate in advising and consenting advising on and consenting to federal judicial nominations, and no such constitutional requirement exists in Canada. That being said, our government, the government that is that represents or commands the majority of the House of Commons or otherwise has the confidence of the House of Commons, that's accountable to the House of Commons and that has to go back to the voters and try to secure another mandate at the next federal election, is the entity that is accountable for our judicial appointments in this country. So while the legislature doesn't have the ability to stop a judicial appointment the way that very occasionally happens in the United States, if a government makes poor judicial appointments or takes the judiciary through its appointments in a direction that Canadians aren't happy with, then there's an opportunity to hold that government accountable for its judicial appointments at the next election. So that is a democratic means of accountability for judicial nominations. And it's probably one reason why our judicial nominations process doesn't look like the American one does, not in terms of the process itself. As I said, there's a constitutional reason for that difference, but because of the outcomes, the kinds of judges that get appointed. There just, I don't think, in my assessment, is an appetite for the kinds of partisan, as you described them, judicial appointments in Canada that we see in the United States. And if a government in Canada were to try to make the appointments process more partisan, and we can talk about whether that would even be possible in the context of Canadian law, I don't know that the Canadian electorate would take too kindly to that. Maybe some aspects of the electorate would. And there certainly were arguments when Mr. Harper was prime minister that that's something that his government was trying to do, albeit, as you noted, with mixed success. There was a point at which almost the entire Supreme Court of Canada had been nominated by the Conservative government. And as you say, they were striking down Conservative legislation left and right. And some of the judges, at least the one I clerked for, was appointed by Brian Mulroney, another Conservative prime minister. But even if a government could kind of put its thumb on the scale in a partisan way through its judicial appointments, I'm not convinced that the electors who ultimately decide the outcomes of Canadian elections, the more moderate centrist voters who swing typically between the Liberals and the Conservatives, would be all that keen on a government taking that approach. Contrast that to the United States, where there are strong movements within the Democratic and Republican parties that are specifically orientated around getting certain kinds of judicial nominees on the bench. We've never seen that in Canada. We can talk about why, but because ultimately a government has to answer at the next election for its judicial appointments, I don't think they're the kinds of political rewards available to a Canadian government for approaching judicial nominations in the partisan way that American administrations tend to do.
Yeah, so, I mean, Adam, that definitely perfectly kind of leads into the next question we have for you is, what do you personally think the state of, like, partisanship and polarization really is in our courts and even in our society, you know, in Canada? For example, Russell Brown made some very partisan statements before he was nominated, you know, even going so far as to refer to Prime Minister Trudeau as unspeakably awful or something like that. But, you know, his rulings have not been, you know, out of right field. He's not revered like the Conservatives, like Scalia in USA, you know, for the Republicans, and has seemingly not made as much of a stir on the Supreme Court. So in your opinion, what kind of, are these certain kind of, you know, social dynamics that are going on in our country?
I think you make a good point. I don't think there is a basis in fact that anyone could point to say that Justice Brown is a conservative, capital C conservative judge. He might be lowercase c conservative in some of his thinking about some particular areas of the law, but it would be extremely difficult to construct an argument, I think impossible, that his votes on particular Supreme Court cases track what you would expect the Conservative Party, if it could, what its votes would be on particular Supreme Court cases. And I think the same can be said of just about every judge on the Supreme Court of Canada and just about every single appellate judge in the country and every trial judge in the country. And that's so, I actually, for a couple of reasons. The first one is that it would be hard to determine what exactly the conservative preference would be with respect to most of the kinds of legal issues that make it to the Supreme Court of Canada. Andrew mentioned the tough on crime legislation that the Harper government brought in and the mandatory minimums that were struck down in the Noor case in 2015. That would be an example where you would expect conservative, capital C conservative judges, if they existed, to vote in the way the government wanted them to, and for capital L liberal judges to vote the other way. But those decisions didn't actually break down quite on those terms, and certainly not in terms of which party had appointed which of the judges to the Supreme Court bench. But generally speaking, there, unlike in the United States, there are no constitutional doctrines that have been endorsed wholeheartedly by any political party or the other. So in the U.S., you mentioned Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia, when he was a legal academic and a lawyer in the U.S. Justice Department in the 70s and the 80s, made a name for himself as an exponent of originalism, which is actually a very broad term and encompasses several related but inconsistent doctrines of constitutional interpretation. And that's a subject for another podcast. But because originalist reasoning was easily harnessed, or readily harnessed, maybe not easily, to achieve ends in conservative constitutional adjudication that the Republican Party liked on issues like abortion or gay marriage or whatever, these sort of hot button social issues, the conservative judicial establishment within the Republican Party endorsed that approach to deciding constitutional issues with both arms, and deliberately set about appointing judges to the federal bench in the United States who would espouse those views and whose judgments would reflect them. We've never seen anything remotely like that in Canada. You know, we sometimes discuss originalism as a Canadian philosophy of constitutional interpretation. But as Carrie Frock, who's a professor at the University of New Brunswick, has written, it's actually not clear that originalism achieves conservative outcomes in Canadian constitutional adjudication. Because what, you're going to go back to Pierre Trudeau in 1982 in the Charter? It's tough to get to the same destination politically using a particular allegedly ideological approach to judging the way that you've seen in the United States in the Canadian legal context. So because there's no partisan association with particular methods of judging, it becomes extremely difficult to map judicial decision making onto through a partisan lens once judges are on the bench. Another reason is that, unlike in the US, the federal courts, which get all the press, and you know, we read about the US Supreme Court, the American Supreme Court actually has a far narrower subject matter jurisdiction than the Canadian Supreme Court does. Since a case in the 1930s, I think, 1940s, called Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, there, the U.S. Supreme Court has basically taken the position that common law is a matter for the state courts to decide, and there is no federal common law in the United States. So torts cases and contract cases don't make it to the U.S. Supreme Court unless there's some federal jurisdiction issue or a federal statutory issue that brings that kind of case within the subject matter jurisdiction of Article III federal courts. In Canada, by contrast, our Supreme Court hears family law cases and contract cases and tort cases, and so has a much broader docket than the U.S. Supreme Court does. And constitutional cases form, commensurately, a much smaller percentage of the cases that our Supreme Court hears. So in the way that the media covers the high courts in both countries, because it's much less exciting, and I say this as someone who has litigated contract cases and tort cases, in some cases all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada, those cases get a lot less press and are a lot less exciting to the media and to Canadians who aren't legally trained, because they tend to be a little bit more esoteric and so forth. And so we don't have the same kind of discussion about these hot button constitutional issues, because there just aren't that many of them. Even if there were a partisan vocabulary to approach them that would allow you to look at judicial decision making through a partisan lens, there just wouldn't be that many cases to have case studies about that kind of decision making. The last point I'll make, because this answer has been way longer than it should have been, is that, unlike in the United States, partisanship itself in Canada is very different. The average American is confronted with an opportunity to register as a member or affiliate of one political party or another when they register to vote. You register as a Republican, you register as a Democrat. So a significant number of Americans identify in partisan terms. I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, my family are Republicans. They talk in that way in the United States. In Canada, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the electorate and of the population that actually formally affiliates with a political party. It's like hundreds of thousands, as opposed to in the United States, where it's millions and millions of people. And so in the US, Americans are accustomed to thinking about one another in partisan terms. You know, I went to law school in the US, as Andrew mentioned, and I had classmates who were Republicans, not because they had gone out and like written a check for 10 bucks to the party and joined with a formal membership process, but because they registered as Republicans and they identified as Republicans. In Canada, there aren't that many liberals. There are people who vote liberal. There are people who might identify as liberal in a casual way, but it's a much softer form of identity, and it's not something that you assume other people are going to have. So Americans being more accustomed to thinking about one another and talking about one another in partisan terms are much more receptive to thinking about their judges in the same terms, and therefore viewing legal issues in the same terms. We just don't have that basic cultural and political vocabulary in Canada, at least not in the same way.
Right, yeah. No, and it was good that you kind of went over and made a long explanation of that, because you really answered kind of my next question too. And I remember also learning kind of when I was studying political science at University of Toronto, you know, this idea of small L liberal versus small C conservative, you know, there is divisions, but it's more ideological and people aren't necessarily, you know, I am liberal, capital L, this is my party, you know, wave the flag, that sort of thing. We're not as, I guess, patriotic wouldn't be the right word, but it could be another word for it. Okay, so right. As I mentioned, you kind of mentioned or answered my other question. So Andrew, would you like to ask the next question?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to build on a point that you made about American cases being, I guess, not more interesting, but more, well, definitely more interesting to read. Because I've always thought of landmark American cases like Brown v. Board of Education and Roe versus Wade. And when I started law school in Canada, I found it quite funny that a lot of the groundbreaking, landmark cases in Canada were about food labeling, which I always found to be a really interesting contrast.
Yeah. Margarine and eggs.
Exactly. Yeah. Irwin Toy, you know, children's advertisement regulations. But I wanted to go back to something that you said about originalism. Do you think it's unquestioned? It's less of an issue in Canada because Viscount Sankey comes out and says in the Persons case that we use a living tree doctrine here in Canada. Whereas in the United States, no, there's never been a judge that says we use originalism or we use a living tree.
That's a good question. The living tree metaphor that comes from the Parsons case from whatever it was, the 1880s. Was it the Parsons case? No, it was Edwards. It was the Parsons case, where that paradigm of constitutional interpretation has had a troubled and tortured history throughout Canadian constitutional law. And I say that not because there's something problematic with it. I say it because our courts have been notoriously inconsistent when it comes to how they actually approach the constitutional method and how you go about constitutional interpretation. For example, the living tree doctrine was originally applied to the understanding of the word person in the Constitution Act 1867, the British North America Act, as it was then called, and the issue of whether women were eligible for appointment to the Senate. Does that mean that that same doctrine applies to the rest of the Constitution, to the federalism provisions of the Constitution in Section 91 and Section 92? Does it mean that it necessarily applies to the Charter? Courts never actually decided that issue, and it's never, as you say, Andrew, been front and center in a judicial opinion since Sankey. Although different judges will deploy living tree reasoning and the living tree metaphor for the purposes of achieving particular outcomes in their constitutional judging at different points throughout history. But in the U.S., it's a much clearer divide where judges kind of stake their flag in the ground on the terrain they want to defend when it comes to the question of constitutional interpretation itself. It's actually, and if you read recent Supreme Court of Canada cases, it's actually very rare that the court, I don't even remember the last time the court spoke of the living tree in the context of a charter decision. And I'm not even sure when the last time the court invoked that metaphor in the division of powers context was. Courts talk about the large and liberal purposive interpretation of charter provisions that was endorsed in the Irwin Toy decision that you mentioned, and in the other early charter cases like Hunter and Southam and others from the 1980s. And that has remained a consistent thread throughout constitutional judging ever since. There are also recent cases where the court has debated among the different members of the court about the role of international law and international legal principles in interpreting charter provisions, about the role of text and the constitutional text and the scheme of the Constitution in interpreting different constitutional provisions. So this debate does happen in Canada, but it's kind of happened in a subtle and sometimes beneath the waves way, in a way that in the United States, it's broken out into the open. But fundamentally, the reason this matters, if we're talking about the politicization of the judiciary, which really, I don't like the word politicization because judging at the appellate level is always going to have some politics in it, the lowercase p sense of the word politics. It's more the partisanization of the judiciary that we see in the United States that is what makes people nervous and that what we seek not to emulate in Canada. If we're talking about that issue, then the reason why methods of constitutional interpretation matter is that there aren't, you don't have the liberals running for office, for example, saying, if you elect us, we're going to appoint living tree judges. That has never been an argument, to my knowledge, ever made in Canadian politics ever. Nor do you have conservatives running for office saying, if you appoint us, we're going to appoint originalist judges, or we're going to appoint textualist judges, or judges who don't consider international law sources to be relevant in the interpretation of charter provisions. Because most Canadians would not care wouldn't know what that meant and wouldn't care. And that's probably a good thing. And so if you look at a decision like for example, you mentioned Roe versus Wade, the American abortion rights case. If you look at the Canadian equivalent, which is the Morgenthaler 2 decision from the 1980s, there you don't have conservatives running for office saying that decision was made because the court in Morgenthaler adopted a particular approach to constitutional interpretation that led to that outcome, and we seek to appoint judges who will not take that approach and who will instead take a more conservative ideology or conservative interpretive methodology when it comes to approaching controversial decisions, so that kind of outcome wouldn't arise again, or they're going to overturn Morgenthaler or whatever. Conservatives don't talk about that. They don't talk like that in Canada, and they never have. And part of that is because, as I said, you don't have the encampment of members of the judiciary and members of the political elite in terms of methods of constitutional or statutory interpretation, the way you see in the United States. And the other thing that we haven't yet talked about, but that is also part of it, is that our Constitution is worded differently than the American Constitution is. In the Morgenthaler decision, for example, the Supreme Court expressly left open the possibility of Parliament passing another abortion law that would restrict or somehow limit or condition access to abortion, just not the way that it had been conditioned in the law that it invalidated in Morgenthaler. And the Parliament has had, what, almost 40 years to figure out a way to do that, and it has declined to do so. The Mulroney government made some movements in that direction. It never went anywhere. Stephen Harper was prime minister for, a decade, and there was no moves in that direction. So the issue was kicked back to the political branches. And it's not like in the United States where all the action is in the Supreme Court. There could be action in the legislative sphere in Canada because we have a constitutional order that maintains parliamentary supremacy. You see that in the notwithstanding clause in Section 33 of the Constitution Act 1982. And we have a court that has, and famously every law student has at least heard of the term dialogue in the context of constitutional adjudication, comes from the Hogg and Bushnell article from, I think, the early 90s. But there's a sense, I think, in among Canadian judges that they are not necessarily going to be the last word on every issue of constitutional significance. There is a role for the legislature, and that takes some of the partisan pressure off, I think, what might otherwise exist for our judiciary. Whereas in the United States, because under the way that they approach constitutional adjudication, you kind of have judicial supremacy on some of these issues. The action has to be at the Supreme Court level. That's where the political forces, the partisan forces, focus their attention. And they use the vocabulary of constitutional interpretation. To go back to your question, Andrew, they use, in the 1980s and 90s, there was a strong conservative movement against living constitutionalism, which is kind of like living tree constitutionalism, in the United States. That was part of the mainstream political discussion, because that was the language in which conservative Republicans expressed their view that the Warren Court, the Supreme Court of the United States, had taken the law in a liberal direction that they weren't happy with, the Warren and Berger courts. They wanted to right the balance. They found the language of constitutional interpretation to express their disagreement, and they had that as their philosophy of judicial appointments. We've never seen anything like that in Canada for the reasons we've talked about.
I think that leads pretty nicely to my question for you. I think it's particularly interesting how you discuss how pervasive the Federalist Society is in the United States, and kind of how there's the intellectual division, and that how that kind of has come to mirror in American party politics. And I guess what I'm curious to know is, the Runnymede Society has made overtures that they want to be like the Federalist Society, which in the United States has obviously created a production line of conservative judges, six of the nine judges from the Federalist Society. So do you think that what's happening in the States is something that could happen here?
I don't want to prognosticate. I don't know what the future will hold in terms of our judicial appointments culture. I would be very surprised if Canada followed that trajectory because of the cultural and political differences that we've talked about. I do think that the comparison of the Runnymede Society to the Federalist Society is not really an accurate one. I attended Federalist Society events when I was in law school. I went to law school in the US. I have, you know, friends who were very active in FedSoc at the law school I went to. And I have been involved in as a, you know, a guest speaker and things for the Runnymede Society, and know folks who've been involved in organizing their events since I've been in practice in Canada. And they are very, very different organizations. I think Runnymede's mandate is very clearly to ensure that there are diversity of viewpoints expressed about challenging political subjects and challenging legal subjects on law school campuses. And so they will organize speaking events where the speakers are, you know, you could not in a million years characterize the speakers as conservative in any way. It's more about diversity and having debates and having discussions. And yes, I think that there's some commitment or some rhetoric that you will hear at Runnymede Society events more than elsewhere about the rule of law and other concepts that have come to have a conservative overtones to them. But I don't think it's fair to compare Runnymede to FedSoc. It doesn't have the same kind of political mission, at least not in my experience or my perception. Whether, you know, and I think that there will always be, and there should always be, debate on law school campuses and in law faculties about the appropriate way to approach challenging legal issues. I don't think that encouraging that kind of debate, for example, on issues of constitutional interpretation, like my husband is went back to law school a couple of years ago and is actually now a 3L at U of T. So I've kind of lived through his experience by seeing the homework that he's brought home and the readings that he's done, which has, you know, going through law school twice, not the greatest thing, but I love him dearly. And so, you know, happy to pay that price. And I'm a nerd, so I'm happy to go over the stuff again. But I don't think that in the Canadian legal, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, the Canadian legal education model or the Canadian approach to legal education, that you get nearly the same exposure to debates over constitutional interpretation, methodologies of constitutional interpretation that I got as a law student in the United States. So when I do constitutional law in Canada, which I do now as a litigator, my approach is to think in terms of, okay, what is the question? What's the constitutional provision that's being interpreted? And what's the method that I'm going to ask the court to use in order to derive meaning from these words on a page in order to achieve the outcome that my client desires or that I think is right or whatever. That's how I was trained to approach constitutional law, not to start with the cases and figure out like the way you would in a tort or contract case using common law methodology to sort of figure out what the court has said before and apply that law to the facts and come to your result. I'm just trained to think about the interpretation of the text as a first step, because every American, liberal or conservative, is trained to think that way in law school. So to go back to the Runnymede Society, the way I have always perceived its activities is to encourage at least a debate about whether or not that's appropriate and whether that should be how we approach legal questions in Canada. And I don't see in that any danger of a, you know, slip toward where you have in the United States, where the, you know, some senior, I forget the person's title is, but it's like the executive vice president or whatever of the Federalist Society is being consulted by the Republican president on whom should be appointed to the various federal courts. And if the person wasn't involved in FedSoc, they're not going to be on the list and all that thing. That is kind of the way things are in the US. It's obviously an oversimplification. And I don't think, I struggle to imagine us ever being in that place in Canada. Although I do think that it's perfectly legitimate if a conservative government is making judicial appointments for them to seek to appoint judges who have a conservative, what they perceive to be a conservative judicial philosophy, right? We don't like it. You can vote for somebody else at the next election. And that's how the appointments process is supposed to work. More importantly, though, like, what is a conservative judicial philosophy in Canada? There are different judges who espouse it in different ways. They often disagree with each other more than they do with anybody else. And there's no kind of discernible conservative legal program in Canada the way there has been in the US since the 80s, which is really why FedSoc has the power that it does. It came into being around the same time the Justice Department under President Reagan was deliberately trying to make conservative appointments to the federal courts to correct what it saw as the liberal excesses of the Supreme Court of the U.S. under Chief Justices Warren and Berger. Berger, by the way, who was appointed by both Warren and Berger were Republicans, and that wanted to do better, in air quotes, at appointing judges who would have a conservative philosophy than they perceived Richard Nixon to have had when he was president. He appointed, for example, Harry Blackmun, who wrote the majority opinion in Roe versus Wade. So the conservative legal movement in the US is much bigger than FedSoc. FedSoc is just one manifestation of it. And I don't think we have such a movement in Canada any more than we have a liberal legal movement. We just have nerdy lawyers who like talking about constitutional law and who differ in their preferred approaches to that. And having those conversations out in the open seems to me to be a good thing.
Yeah, and I totally agree with everything you're saying. And I think, you know, it's easy to draw comparisons and analogies to conservative movements, whether they be in Canada or whether they be in Europe, in Asia, anything like that, just because, again, going off for ideology's sake, this is kind of easy for us to understand. And so I think that's why, you know, the analogy kind of gets drawn. So to kind of move on to a different point, and this might be a very broad question, Adam, but if you were, you know, a decision maker or a politician, who knows, maybe if that's in your future, who was in charge of, you know, making judicial appointments or, you know, reforming the process, would you do anything differently?
That is a broad question. And I confess it's not something I've thought a ton about because I'm not going to be in that position probably ever. And that maybe is a very good thing. But I think that different governments in Canada have experimented with this in different ways because it is a hard question. Canadians, I think justifiably, want visibility into how judicial appointments are made. There was a dissatisfaction that was expressed broadly toward the end of the Liberal government that lasted from Jean Chrétien and after 1993 to Paul Martin at the end of 2006, or beginning of 2006. By the end of the Martin years, I think Canadians were tired or wanted to have more visibility into how Supreme Court appointments in particular were being made. And so the government of Prime Minister Martin opened things up and created a process that had parliamentary involvement and so forth. The Harper government continued that, and there was public, and their first couple appointments were made using a similar process with parliamentary committee hearings so that Canadians, either by watching on TV or through their representatives in parliament, would have an opportunity to kick the tires of judicial appointments to the Supreme Court of Canada before they took their seats on the bench. Even though parliament didn't have the power to torpedo a nomination through some legal means, it wasn't inconceivable that if a nominee performed exceptionally badly in front of the parliamentary committee or something was revealed through that process that made them an undesirable appointment, that the government might have changed course. That never happened, but that is something that the government opened itself up to by approaching appointments that way under Martin and then the early Harper years. And then after the situation with Justice Nadon, who was appointed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that he wasn't eligible, the Harper government made its last couple appointments without any kind of public process. They just announced the nominee. And I don't think there was a lot of consternation about the closedness of that process among Canadians more broadly. I mean, people have other things to care about. It was never, as I recall, a significant or salient political issue that the last couple of Stephen Harper appointees to the Supreme Court of Canada were not made through a public process. But obviously, when Prime Minister Trudeau took office and they had the opportunity to make their first appointment to replace Justice Cromwell, there was a move back to the open process and in fact, a much more structured open process than had ever existed before, which Andrew described at the beginning of our conversation. I think that there's going to continue to be flux on this. I think governments are going to continue to do things in slightly different ways. This is because, unlike in the US, as Andrew mentioned, we don't have the constitutional requirement of doing things in a particular way. And I think that history will ultimately, you know, there will be potentially appointments that are made through the process that the Trudeau government has introduced, which may or may not survive the next change of government, whenever that happens. And there may be some appointments through that process that don't work out the way that the government in power wants them to, or that backfire in some publicly embarrassing way for the government, which prompts the government to change its approach again. Or it may be that continues to be the process forever. I don't know. I think ultimately the criteria, what's more important than thinking about a particular model, is thinking about the criteria by which we judge the process of appointing judges to our courts. If Canadians have confidence that judicial nominations and judicial appointments are being made in a way that's based on merit, where that our judges are going to be high quality intellects who have the independence and impartiality to fairly and justly decide the issues that come before them, and that this isn't some behind the scenes, you know, patronage racket where unqualified people are being nominated because they gave money to the right people or whatever. As long as that perception is avoided and the first perception of a quality process is maintained, it really doesn't matter specifically what process you use. You have to judge by outcomes rather than process, I think, in this regard. But there are always going to be issues and stories in the news about this judge got appointed and they gave $1,000 to the party in power 5 years ago, or they've given consistently to the party in power, you know, $200 a year over the last 10 years. And opposition parties sometimes will get up in arms about that. You know, I think that journalists get more excited about those kinds of stories than lawyers do, because, totally, you know, judges are people. And really, you think someone giving $200 a year to the Liberals or $2,000 a year to the Liberals means they're going to rule a certain way on cases? Come on. Nobody really thinks that. Nor do they think that judicial appointments can be bought so cheaply. And there are all these processes that Andrew described that you have to get through in order to even get to the minister's office to be considered for an appointment in Canada. And that's been the case for a very long time. But there will and there should continue to be a debate about how we do this, how open it should be. And I think that will continue. How would I do it, though? I think the first question is, do Canadians have confidence in the judicial appointments that are being made? If the answer is yes, that's a strong case for leaving things, continuing to do things the way that we are currently doing them.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think transparency is something that's very important, especially, you know, given kind of the current, not even political climate, but social climate. I think everyone has immediate and instant access to, you know, any information that they could ever want on the internet, right? So as long as there is transparency, I think that's kind of what people crave. And I agree with you. If it's working, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah, and there are also political incentives that are good in the judicial appointments process. For example, right now, you know, there's going to be a vacancy on the Supreme Court of Canada this summer. Justice Abella will reach the retirement age of 75. I think on Canada Day is her birthday, on July the 1st. She will be a very difficult judge to replace because of just the size of her presence on that court and the magnitude of her judicial legacy. And the government is going to have to make decisions about whom it considers and then whom it ultimately appoints to replace her. Those factoring into that decision, and this would be true whether it was a Liberal government or a Conservative government, it might be a Conservative government by the summer, I don't know, that gets to make this call, they're going to consider things like, you know, Justice Abella is a woman and the Supreme Court right now has four women judges and five male judges. Mm-hmm. Are we going to appoint a man to replace Justice Abella and have it become 6-3 for the first time in a long time? Because it's important. We have a legal profession where most law school graduates are women. We have a country, obviously, that isn't, you know, 67% male. And the Supreme Court should look like the country whose laws it's adjudicating. So that's an important consideration, which the government is going to be held to by political considerations. That's a good thing. Similarly, there's never been a person of color on the Supreme Court of Canada. Long since overdue that we have that kind of representation on the highest court in the land. That's going to factor into the decision as well. Might not end up being that this next appointment is a person of color, but that is a consideration and should be a consideration, because there's always going to be politics in judicial appointments, because ultimately the government is democratically accountable for them. And that's a good thing. That ensures that we have a diverse and, well, it should ensure, and it will over time, I think, ensure that we have a diverse and representative judiciary, and that will continue to move in that direction over time. And that there will continue to be high quality appointments, because that's what Canadians are going to expect and demand. And that's how it should be.
definitely, definitely. No, and that's all great points that you've made, and I totally agree with everything you said. So kind of answer my question. Andrew, would you like to ask the next question?
Yeah, before I ask my question, I also wanted to make a point that when we talk about expecting judges to rule in a liberal or conservative way, I'm saying that with air quotes because the people listening to the podcast can't see the video. I remember a point made to me by one of my law professors, which is that legal issues rarely split easily along a left or right viewpoints. So many times, you know, you have people who are, you know, diehard leftists, New Democrats or liberals, but they'll have actually a surprisingly conservative view on a particular legal viewpoint. And you'll have conservatives who have a surprising progressive view on another legal viewpoint. So it can be a bit difficult to say, you know, we want a liberal or a conservative judge ruling in a certain way.
Totally. And I find in my own mind, I go back and forth on this constantly. Like my own politics are left of center. And those are my personal policy preferences, no doubt. But when it comes to some legal issues, I sometimes worry that progressives are too keen on having the courts make difficult policy decisions, that ultimately we should hold our legislators to the fire to make those decisions in the way that we prefer, right? Like, just because we have a charter, which is of course a good thing, does not mean that every single difficult policy issue has to be viewed through a charter lens, or can ultimately be viewed through a charter lens. And my concern is that when we use the courts to decide difficult policy issues that don't neatly fall into the constitutional settlement that was agreed to in 1982, that aren't within the parameters that our charter is supposed to exclude government action from, that we usurp the ability of Canadians through elections to hold our legislators accountable for the decisions that they make. You hear me say that? I think that it's very easy to characterize what I just said as a conservative judicial philosophy, but I'm not a conservative person. How do you reconcile that? I think that's a much more common Canadian experience than it is an American experience. And you know, I'm a young lawyer. I'm still, my own thinking on this is still developing. But when I litigate constitutional cases, I wrestle with that each and every time. And I think that's a good and healthy thing, that we should constantly be asking ourselves, what is the role of the judiciary? What are the limits on the judicial role? Because there have to be limits on the judicial role. Everyone agrees on that. Where do we draw that line? There's no objectively right answer. And what are the right policy outcomes in a particular field of endeavor? And how, if at all, should that bear on the kind of adjudication that's being done, particularly in charter cases where, under Section 1, it's impossible to exclude policy considerations from the analysis, because what on earth, under the Oakes framework that we've used for 30 years, what on earth is a salutary effect and a detrimental effect, but language for expressing policy outcomes of a particular decision? So if we accept that there's going to be policy in judging, and we accept that there's going to be a limit on the judicial role, then we're arguing about the shades of gray that exist between those or within those limits. And that's good and that's healthy. But I agree with your professor, Andrew, that if you were to do a poll of where Canadians think those lines should be drawn, it would not map neatly onto their policy preferences as a political matter, and certainly not as a partisan matter. And that is a, I think, significant difference between the legal and political culture in Canada and the legal and political culture in the United States.
So, you know, to wrap things up and kind of on the line of looking at the Canadian system in comparison to our neighbors, if you were to, in 30 seconds or less, kind of give us a rundown of what you think it's something that the Canadian judiciary does exceptionally well. It doesn't have to be big, just something that I guess we do well in Canada that you could maybe say others don't.
Oi, 30 seconds. I think we have an exceptionally strong judiciary in Canada. We have really, really good judges. We don't talk about that enough. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a litigator who has to appear in front of them and I want to butter them up. Like, I really think that by any objective measure, we have exceptionally good judges in Canada. And we have a court system that avoids the kind of procedural wrangling that defines litigation in the United States. What courts should we be in, the state court or the federal court or whatever? And so the focus is much more on the issues, and a premium is placed on getting the answer right and doing justice. I think we have our judges as a whole strike a good balance between between doing justice in a particular case between the parties before them and applying the law, the common law principles or the statutory authority that applies to a particular dispute in a way that is consistent and that ensures that people in Canada know how we should order our affairs under the laws that we have. We're always going to argue about the extent to which we get that right, but that is ultimately has to be the goal of any judiciary in any system governed by the rule of law. And Canada does exceptionally well, I think, compared to just about any country in the world at striving toward and achieving that desirable outcome, which is not to disparage other countries. I just think we should pat ourselves on the back that by any global, reasonable global standard, we do very well at that.
Adam, thank you for taking the time to join us for this discussion on the Canadian judicial system. It's been a delight It's been a delight to listen to your point of view and learn from you. I got some words I'd like to share before we wrap it up. Before Chief Justice McLaughlin retired from her record 28 years on the court, she reflected on her experiences during one of her last press conferences. She said, "We have a public that values an independent judiciary, which is the best defense in the final analysis. If the people stand up and say, you can't attack our judiciary, we want an independent judiciary, that is, in a democracy such as ours, the best way to preserve judicial independence. We need to continue to hold our politicians to account. We need to continue to stay engaged as active, informed citizens in our society. It's not easy, but no one ever promised that the work of democracy was easy." This wraps up part two of our series, Exploring the Canadian and American Judiciary. Once again, I would like to thank you for joining us on Pro Bono Radio. And to all of our listeners out there, thank you for tuning in.
This podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of the PBSC Queen's Law Student Volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer.
We're your hosts, Andrew, Emily, and Rebecca. If you like this interview, you can find more on Queen's Pro Bono Radio website at probonoradio.com. Thank you all, and stay safe out there.